You're listening to Nitty Gritty Nursing with Nurse M, where she breaks down the nitty gritty basics of nursing concepts. Alrighty, in this episode of Nitty Gritty Nursing, we are going to sort of break down hepatic encephalopathy and what causes it, what we would do as nurses, and how we would go about assessing the patients that have this. Now, it's kind of an important disease process that we are abundantly aware of, because in the United States, and this is as of last year, there was an article that I read that demonstrated that approximately 5.5 million people in the United States have hepatic cirrhosis. And hepatic cirrhosis, if you go and you listen to the Liver 101 and Cirrhosis podcast episode that I did, you will know that hepatic cirrhosis is when the liver scars over as a result of some sort of complication or lifestyle, whether that was increased alcohol consumption, whether that was a viral illness that attacked their liver, like hepatitis, and damaged it. There's a lot of different reasons why people would get hepatic cirrhosis, but one of the end results of that is a major complication that can sort of arise is hepatic encephalopathy. And it's that complication that imposes a burden on patients and families and the healthcare system that can be easily treated if caught or easily prevented if appropriate education is provided. So here's a few things to keep in mind when we think about hepatic encephalopathy. The main reason why this happens is that the liver has become cirrhotic. The liver has failed. And this hepatic encephalopathy in and of itself is a nervous system disorder that is really brought on by that severe liver disease. When the liver doesn't work properly, the toxins then build up in the blood, and then those toxins travel to the brain. And basically our brains end up swirling around in a bunch of neurotoxins, which then affect their ability to think, to articulate, to mentate, and also even their neuromotor function. And when you think back to what the liver is doing, right, there's so many different components and activities that the liver does for the body in order for someone to live successfully. It makes albumin, it makes bile, it helps to make clotting factors. And the big thing is that it's a detoxifying organ for our entire body. So you have, again, think back to the basic vasculature of the blood flow going into the liver to perfuse it from the abdominal aorta. And then you've got the venous return through the hepatic veins into the inferior vena cava, which goes back to the heart. And then you have that portal vein, and that portal vein has all of the blood vessels around the stomach, the spleen, the pancreas. So as food, as drugs, as anything that you're consuming and dropping into your body is put into that stomach, and it starts to be broken down, and those elements start to be absorbed and they get into the bloodstream. Everything then goes through that portal vein to the liver to be filtered. And when the liver doesn't work, those toxins, for example, that the liver is supposed to help manage and get rid of in order to make sure that we don't die, it doesn't work. And then we get an increased load in it. So that diseased liver struggles to filter those toxins. And those substances are things that are created from that breakdown of food. The big one that we're going to talk about is specifically protein. And when protein is broken down, it produces ammonia, even alcohol, medications. And so when we get a buildup specifically of ammonia, which we'll talk about, these patients will then end up with the classic hepatic encephalopathy, which leads to impaired mental status and impaired neuromotor function. And those signs and symptoms of a neuromotor impairment include things like hyperreflexia or myoclonus, or the big one, which nursing schools and I think the NCLEX in general really like to hit on, is that asterixis, which is that flapping of the hands that you can see if you have someone who has a liver disease or liver cirrhosis and you're worried about the buildup of those neurotoxins. If you have them outstretch their arms in front of them with their palms up as if they were going to push against a wall or a door, and you just have them hold that position, their hands will involuntarily flap because of those neurotoxins swirling around the brain in there. Now, up to 50% of the people that end up with liver cirrhosis will eventually develop some sort of symptom of hepatic encephalopathy. The liver can only do so much. And for those of you who are nerds out there and want to know about the three different types of hepatic encephalopathy, there are three: type A, type B, and type C. Type A is basically brought on by some sort of acute liver failure. So it's an acute liver failure, but there's not a an underlying chronic liver disease that was behind the failing of the liver, something acutely happened. Type B occurs in some people who have a shunt that connects two veins inside the liver without underlying liver disease. And then type C results from the chronic liver disease and the scarring or that cirrhosis. And probably in my personal practice, what I've seen the majority of is type C hepatic encephalopathy. So if you are doing a chart review and your patient has liver cirrhosis, and they're being treated for their hepatic encephalopathy, you might see some sort of documentation stipulating that it is a type C sort of hepatic encephalopathy, or you might not. Honestly, if I'm going to be completely blunt, I don't think that in my career I was ever like, hey, type C and hepatic encephalopathy, cool, from chronic liver disease, from cirrhosis. But that's besides the point. Now, when we talk about the neurotoxins that develop in that increase in levels inside the system that lead to the classic hepatic encephalopathy, ammonia is the big one, and any of those toxins that the liver would have filtered out that didn't because it's unable to do its job properly. Now, ammonia is a waste product made by your body as it starts to digest protein. And normally that ammonia is then absorbed into the blood vessels surrounding that stomach and the intestines. And that blood goes to the liver via the portal vein, where it is then processed. And inside the liver, the big thing that it does is your liver takes that ammonia and converts it into urea. And then urea is then passed through the body through our renal system. We then excrete it in our own urine. So when our body cannot process or eliminate that ammonia, like in the event of some sort of liver failure or liver cirrhosis, it builds up in the bloodstream over time. And those high ammonia levels in the blood can actually lead to really serious health problems, including brain damage, coma, even death. And that's where hepatic encephalopathy comes in, and that's why we treat it. So those high ammonia levels, most often caused by liver disease. However, because we know that as we eat protein and it's digested and it's converted into a component of ammonia, which then goes to the liver to be converted into urea, which is then excreted, right? If your liver cannot process it, we will have high circulating levels of ammonia. There's two other big reasons, though, why you might see an increase in ammonia in the system. And that can be the resultant of also some sort of kidney failure or some sort of genetic disorder. So hear me out on this, right? The three reasons why ammonia builds up in the body. Either one, your liver's too damaged and it cannot process the ammonia into urea to then be excreted. The second other reason why ammonia might build up in the body that you might see in your textbooks or even through the NCLEX if they decide to throw a sneaky question at you about it, would be with Ray syndrome. And that's a serious and sometimes fatal condition that really causes damage to both the liver and the brain. And it affects mostly children and teenagers who are recovering from some sort of viral infection or like chickenpox or the flu, and they took aspirin to treat their illness. Now, the cause of Ray syndrome is really unknown, but what we do know is that children and teens should not be taking aspirin unless specifically recommended by their provider, because it can then cause damage to that liver and to the brain, buildup of ammonia. Again, we have ammonia that builds in the body. Another reason is that if there's a urea cycle disorder, right, which is a rare genetic defect in the body that affects the body's ability to change ammonia into urea, right? So it's not just your liver sucks, it's damaged, it doesn't work correctly or as efficiently that causes ammonia to build up. There are other reasons. And so you have to investigate, age of the patient, why they might be there, to sort of validate why potentially ammonia would be built up high enough where you would start to have the neuromotor impairment or mental impairment that you would see. And we know that because it affects both mentation and motor function, right, we can ask our patients to do very specific things. So when we talk about nursing management and interventions, those actions that we are going to take fall back into assessing both of those features. So yes, we will do lab work, right? And of course, we're looking at what's the ammonia level? Is it elevated? Is it not? And then you can also look at other factors that might cue you into the idea that the liver is not doing its job, like what's their bilirubin look like? What's their prothrombin time look like? Because those are key aspects that will help us determine if the liver has failed. But back to the assessment of a patient who's got hepatic encephalopathy. They are confused. They are confused. They lose the ability to control fine motor movements in many cases. One of the things that you might see people do in the clinical setting is have the patient try to write their name. And if it comes out completely erratic and squiggly, it's because the neurotoxins swirling around their brain have affected their ability to control their hand and to write their name out. Similarly, when we talk about their ability to mentate properly, we just do a basic neuroassessment. It goes back to the basics of what is included in a neurological assessment and how do you, as a nurse, ascertain whether or not someone is alert and oriented and has all their mental faculties. Well, alert and orientation is usually predicated on four key components. Are they alert to themselves, to the time, to the situation, and to the place? Switch it up, though, because people get really bored with, all right, tell me where you're located. So the way these patients are going to present is with confusion or with some neuromotor function impairment. Maybe they've got the astrovixis, so when they stick their hands out, you see gentle hand flapping. That would be indicative of those toxins building up in the system. Similarly, when you ask them to tell you what is happening or where they're located or an orientation question and they are unable to answer it or they mumble and they don't make sense, that can also be a clinical indicator to you as a nurse to say that they are not putting these pieces together and maybe they have too much of the neurotoxins swirling around their brain affecting it. So how do we treat it? The gold standard for treating hepatic encephalopathy in the acute care setting currently is to give lactulose, or cefulac is the other name for it, to reduce those serum ammonia levels. And what that basically does is most of the therapies that are used for treating hepatic encephalopathy focus on treating the episodes as they occur and are directed at reducing the nitrogenous load in the gut, which are some of those neurotoxins. So we give lactulose to reduce those serum ammonia levels because lactulose is a non-absorbable sugar composed of galactose and glucose. It was actually first made in 1929, and we use that lactulose because it helps to promote peristalsis in the bowel and bowel evacuation. And because it's such a large molecule, it coaxes ammonia into that gut from the colon. And then as we are increasing that peristalsis and they are having, you know, loads of diarrhea and their bowel is evacuating repeatedly, we are actually going to lower the ammonia level overall. The key with this, right, is because we know that there's an increase in the ammonia in patients with liver cirrhosis that can lead to hepatic encephalopathy. We want to make sure that we're actually reducing their protein intake to help reduce the amount of ammonia that builds up. Now, lactulose can be given one of two ways. It can be given orally, and if you've never seen it, it comes typically in these white, cute little cups, like little dispensing cups where you might see like children's Tylenol in.
Welcome to Fuller Butts, a behind-the-scenes plastic surgery podcast. Yes, you heard that right. Join your co-hosts, Dr. Sam Fuller and Dr. Dan Butts, board-certified plastic and reconstructive surgeons on an exclusive full-access pass into the world of plastic surgery. Combining their expertise and training, Drs. Fuller and Butts will share medical insights, detailed explanations, and lighthearted humor to keep you entertained and informed. We're certain you'll become passionate about the plastic surgery specialty, and between debunking myths, uncovering truths, or just making you laugh out loud at their perspective on this creative and artistic field, we've got something for everyone.
And you open it and it's this dark brown color and it's very sweet because it's that, you know, non-absorbable sugar. It's a huge molecule. And when these patients consume it, it forces ammonia into the gut system and it increases the peristalsis, which leads to diarrhea. So one of the things that you might see on a nursing test is how do you know whether or not the lactulose that is being given to your patient for hepatic encephalopathy is working in reducing ammonia levels. Now, I would venture to argue that the one way, the most discernible and definitive way that you know that the lactulose is working is that their mentation improves. So if they had, you know, that impaired neuromotor function, does that improve? Can they now write their name appropriately? If they were confused, do they now sound like they know what's happening, and can they remain cognizant of the communication that's being had? Because it increases the peristalsis, you're also likely to see bowel movements as one of your answers. And the goal is to have 2 to 3 loose bowel movements a day when these patients are receiving lactulose in the treatment of hepatic encephalopathy to try to lower the ammonia levels. However, I always used this as an example to say, well, but what if your patient, right? Diarrhea is not necessarily the sole clinical indicator to determine whether or not the lactulose is working. Look at their mental status. Look at whether or not they have those mental faculties and they are improving and their neuro exam improves. Because you can have a patient in the hospital, and let's say that they've had a load of antibiotics and now they've got a C. diff infection on top of their hepatic encephalopathy that they're dealing with. Well, the C. diff is going to cause the diarrhea, not necessarily the lactulose. The lactulose is going to make it way worse, don't get me wrong. But we give the lactulose to pull the ammonia back into the gut, increase the peristalsis. It's a huge sugar molecule. And then they excrete it in their stool, and we should see improvements in both their neuro and their motor function. Now, I know I mentioned that we can give lactulose orally, and it's this brown, thick, very like sugary, it almost looks a little bit like syrup. And we give it orally, we have them drink it. Some patients really don't like the taste of it. So one of the tricks I always had is, you know, depending on how many cartons of it they had to drink, I'd put a straw in it and tell them to put that straw as far back in their throat as they could and drink it that way. If they are so altered though, right? Because potentially someone with hepatic encephalopathy could end up in a coma. And if they are so altered that they cannot safely drink a substance without choking on it or aspirating on it, then you can also give this particular medication rectally. You can give it as an enema to reduce the ammonia in the system. If you are giving a patient lactulose though, reason would have it that not only is that medication administration one of the key elements from a nursing perspective that must be upheld, but you should probably also then consider monitoring the serum ammonia levels daily and monitoring those electrolytes as well, because the lactulose is going to cause diarrhea. Well, they're not just pooping out ammonia and bacteria, but also a wide array of other key elements that need to stay in the person's system. Typically, the lactulose is discontinued, right, when the encephalopathy goes away. You would then also give other things like vitamins, you'd give glucose. And more recently, what I read in the literature when I was kind of prepping to do this particular episode is that another medication that they're starting to use is called rifaximin. Now, rifaximin, right, is another medication. It's actually often started after the resolution of an acute episode of hepatic encephalopathy. Sometimes it's even started in the hospital, but it basically modulates the gut microbiome to prevent hepatic encephalopathy in patients that had maybe an acute episode. They came into hospital, we managed them with lactulose and kept them hydrated and kept all of the essential nutrients on board. But rifaximin in and of itself is actually an antibiotic that is minimally absorbed in the gut, and it's used to treat traveler's diarrhea that's caused from bacteria. So its main purpose in life is it's an antibiotic, and its main purposes in life is that it's used to treat traveler's diarrhea or some sort of IBS. However, what they have found is that it can also be used to prevent hepatic encephalopathy. And so the medications that we can give, right, for this are now both lactulose acutely and rifaximin. Now, lactulose can also be given at home, and some patients with liver cirrhosis will be on lactulose just at baseline in order to prevent the ammonia levels from increasing to the point where they enter hepatic encephalopathy. So it can be used as management. Rifaximin also can be used in that manner as well. However,
The cost of rifaximin and why it's not more widely utilized is 1 month's supply of this drug could cost upwards of $1,000 to $2,000 for many people, and that is not covered by insurance. When in comparison, the cost of lactulose for these patients is closer to $10 to $20 a month. So you have a huge financial discrepancy between the utilization of lactulose and the utilization of rifaximin. So those are two medications that can be used to treat it. Now, in terms of monitoring your patients, right, you want to closely monitor the neurologic status for any changes. We're talking about assessing their level of consciousness, monitoring for restlessness and agitation. Again, think back when someone has liver cirrhosis and the buildup of neurotoxins and their brain starts to get swirled in toxins up in their little head, they might become restless and agitated. Their motor function is going to become impaired because they're not going to be able to put things together. So we want to monitor their handwriting daily. It becomes worse with increasing ammonia levels. So as we use that as a point of assessment, when we're monitoring their handwriting daily and we're giving them lactulose or maybe rifaximin in the hospital setting, that should improve. And we're going to continue to monitor for their serum ammonia values every day. And we're going to monitor for signs of impending coma. And we're going to try to reduce or eliminate the client's dietary protein intake if we think that the ammonia levels are so high that it could lead to coma. Same with electrolytes, right? We need to monitor those electrolytes because as we give lactulose and increase the peristalsis in their gut and colon, yes, it's drawing the ammonia in or reducing the ammonia levels, but we're also getting rid of fluid. We're getting rid of electrolytes. We're getting rid of really key essential items that patients must have in order to survive. You then also want to continue to do your assessments. So what does that look like? A basic neurologic assessment on your patient that is fast, right? And I'm coming from an emergency room perspective. I'm sure there are going to be neuro nurses out there that are just appalled at what I'm going to say next. But when you're dealing with someone who has potentially hepatic encephalopathy, go back to the basics of what a good neurological exam looks like. Yes, assess for their alert and orientation status. ANO times 3, ANO times 4, depending on which shop you're in and how many questions you ask. But then look at their eyes, look at their pupils. Do those extra ocular movements where you have them look up, down, left, right. Follow the pen and crisscross. Have them stick their tongue out. Have them smile. Have them grip your hands to test for that strength. Bilaterally, have them stick their arms out with their palms facing you to see if their hands start flapping. Do their dorsal and their pedal dorsiflexion down on their feet. And just go back to the basics. And every time you establish that assessment parameter, when you go back in to evaluate your patient, you need to replicate it because as they continue to consume the lactulose, as they continue to be treated and the ammonia levels decrease, you should start to see marked improvements in both their neurologic status and their motor function status. And then we have to educate these people. These individuals who are suffering with liver cirrhosis, and we know that one of the big culprits is protein consumption. Well, we can't just say, no, you don't get to eat any protein. Hello, it is a building block to life. But there are stipulations behind how much they should be eating. It's not like they're going to start eating 100 grams of protein a day. If they do that, think about the amount of ammonia that would be circulating in their system because their liver cannot convert it to urea and their kidneys can then not excrete the urea because it's not in existence, because the ammonia is still circulating in the system. So we think about these basic steps behind someone who's suffering from hepatic encephalopathy, why it's happening, and how do we treat that while we are assessing them to ensure that improvements are being made as they are being treated for this. So this is hepatic encephalopathy, the nitty-gritty version. I'm sure there's more that I could go into about this, but this is the basics. If nothing else that you take away, hepatic encephalopathy is the resultant of neurotoxins swirling in the brain, often ammonia, from protein byproduct because the liver is damaged and it cannot convert it into urea. How do you treat that? What does that look like? They're going to be confused and their motor function is going to be messed up. They're not going to be able to do their handwriting. They're going to have hand flapping. And neurologically, they're not going to have all of the correct mentation components. And so you think about that and how we treat it. Lactulose to get rid of the ammonia. The new one, rifaximin, that's coming out, which is that antibiotic used to treat traveler's diarrhea. There's been some good studies on it. I can't tell you that they're going to test on that in the NCLEX world, but you are likely potentially to see that clinically if you're taking care of these patients. And then how do we educate our patients to not fall back into this? And again, that falls back to lifestyle, whether or not they're eating a lot of protein, whether or not they're taking a baseline lactulose dose at home to prevent that ammonia buildup from occurring. So these are all things to consider. So that's all I've got on hepatic encephalopathy. Go forth and keep on learning.